Though there is no known record of an escape or assault by a prisoner giving birth, all inmates, male and female, who leave state institutions for community hospitals are shackled and guarded by at least one armed correctional officer. That includes 185 women prisoners on average who give birth each year in California prisons. As many as 64 California prisoners die unnecessarily each year from medical negligence or malpractice, according to the U.S. District Court, which seized control of the system July 1st. The receiver has yet to be named, and it is unlikely the treatment of prisoners giving birth will be an immediate priority. Between 1998 and 2004, California prisoners gave birth to 1,300 babies, the majority conceived prior to their mother's sentencing. Most of those babies went home with relatives or into foster care. And from California Prison Focus, a quote from Dr. Corey Weinstein, who states, "Active labor means contractions that are regular, forceful, and coordinated, and that could go on for 36 hours. A correctional medical consultant who serves on the board of San Francisco-based California Prison Focus. Women interviewed by advocacy groups report being restrained and told the pushing stage, the last part of active labor, a practice Dr. Corey Weinstein described as barbaric."
I mean, that's basically what it is, barbaric. It's you know, it's good that this issue is coming to some light. I think there's been a couple articles recently in the Chronicle and in Contra Costa Times.
Basically, the bottom line of the Department of Corrections is them saying, basically, we don't want them to escape.
Yeah.
And it's that it's part of their mission of public safety. So what does public safety have to do with shackling a woman to a prison bed when she's giving childbirth?
Yeah.
You know, and here these people are so concerned about our youth, about our children, but yet they're bringing into this world a chained baby.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the mentality we're dealing with the California Department of Corrections. You know, it's just been like that for the last 30, 40 years that I've known about.
Yeah.
It's just barbaric. Their thinking's barbaric.
Yeah.
Not just their practices.
That's it. We need to, you know, and tell folks listening also to, you know, to kind of to get involved here and write letters, whether to, you know, to the editor of your newspaper or, you know, to your local representatives, pressuring them, because there is a bill right now, I believe, that is in the state assembly that will, you know, will change this, basically, that will allow women to be unshackled during labor. And, you know, I mean, it's simply an issue of basic humanity, I think, you know, more than anything, just so that a woman would not be shackled to the bed, you know, during this very important time.
I think we have to make a special appeal to, you know, our governor here that, listen, governor, you know, hopefully, you know, you come to your senses, you know, about some of the issues inside the prison walls, but the one regarding women in prison and, you know, women in SHU, I think that California Prison Folk had just returned, I think last week, from Valley State Prison, visiting some of the women kept there, and there's reportedly a woman that's been kept in solitary confinement for the last 10 years.
Wow. Yeah.
SHU confinement there, you know. These are the kind of things that, you know, we're mandated as a non-for-profit California Prison Focus to, you know, bring to the public forum so people can know about the horrible conditions that are taking place inside prison, you know, in respect to, you know, our women prisoners. They're part of the invisible prison class, along with, you know, medical neglect, along with people that, you know, that are in need of, you know, of certain diets, that are in need of, you know, eyeglasses, that are in need of wheelchairs. These are the invisible prisoners that are being most impacted you know, by the negligence shown so far by this governor, you know, that's come into power with all these sweeping reforms. And so far as we've known, all he's did was change the name of the Department of Corrections.
Yep.
You know, that's all he did.
Very
so we're addressing him, you know, in the most respectful way as a responsible community grassroots organization to, you know, focus on women being chained up in prison, you know, regardless of where they are, whether they're given babies or not. You know, they chain them anytime they take them to go anywhere, because the guards, that's what pays them, chaining people. That's what makes their, you know, their paychecks. They got to chain people, you know.
That's it.
It's not about safety or anything like that, you know. It's just about how can a woman flat on her back giving birth to a child be a danger to anybody. And yet they have round-the-clock security on that person. Why? Because, hey, that security is paying like maybe $50 an hour. Who knows?
Just as the issues that came up recently,
those are the
a couple
perks
months.
Kickbacks, you know, to being part of that guards union, man. They take money coming and going anywhere, any kind of dirty money, blood money they can get, they take it, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for bringing those news issues to our attention, Bato. I want to get into part of the interview that Kilu Niasha, a good friend of KPOO, of California Prison Focus, and of all of us, all activists here in the Bay and beyond, interview that Kilu did with Robert Bryan, who is Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney. And who we spoke with not too far back on our show here. But before we get into that, I want to make sure to let folks know about some events coming up. One is the National Asian Pacific Peoples Prisoner Conference in the LA area, and that's going to be happening August 6th at the Filipino Workers Center from 7 to 9 p.m. And that's on 153 Glendale Boulevard in Los Angeles. And for more information on the conference, it's called Revolutionary Nationalism of the 60s and 70s, Lessons Learned, the Relevance and Importance for Today, and the Rebuilding of Our Movement. And there's going to be Bill Gallegos, from the former Brown Beret member, Bilal Ali, former Black Panther, Michael Novick from Students for Democratic Society, and also Mo Nishida, from Asian hardcore community, you know, hardcore community worker.
Who was down with us at Chicano Park about 2 years
exactly.
ago. Mo Ashida, yeah. They're going to be having a great conference down there, yeah.
So, you know, if it's possible to check that out this Saturday, August 6th, it is going to be down in L.A. I think they're going to be folks rolling from the Bay to L.A. But if you want more info on it, you can contact Mo, actually, at 323-371-4502. Or contact us at California Prison Focus, 415-252-9211. And as always, our address is 2940 16th Street, Suite B5, San Francisco, 94103.
And also, this is our first show of August.
It is.
And we want to remind our audience that traditionally, August for the in-prison class means Black August. And probably every single day is Black inside prison when you're doing time, but particularly Black August, and in commemoration of the in-prison class, that on this day we give remembrances and, you know, and commemorate those that have fallen over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years inside the mammoth prison complex here in California that presently holds, I think, up to 165,000, you know, with the revolving door of 80,000 coming and going each year, you know. It's a huge industry, but also we have to look at it as being a place where a lot of human life is, you know, expended needlessly. It's, you know, in dreadful ways, in violence, you know, prison violence and medical neglect. And we should care about these people, because it's a reflection, I think, of our own society, who we taking care of, you know, because anybody can get down and take care of the rich, you know, and cater to them, and, you know, and, but what about the poor, you know? Who's helping them, you know?
Yeah.
So each morning I wake up thankful. This is Vato here at Community Radio KPU Station, who have been very, very gracious help to us in moving our program forward, and on such times that we take this 1 hour that we give to issues behind prison walls and barbed wire, razor wire, You know, we want to remember that these are human beings. It's another world that the majority of America has never been there, visited, not even Mateo yet. And we don't ever want Mateo and people like Mateo who, you know, ever go inside these institutions. But there is a lot of
inside,
youth,
just on the other side of the
you
glass.
Have people that you know, relatives, people that write you from prison, you know, in the work we do. And myself, you know, like I give thanks that Vato's no longer held by what I call Colossosaurus X, this big, huge lizard that eats, you know, up and down California, that eats people, you know, it eats youth. So they have, there's real issues on the other side, and in commemoration of the Black August this month, and also with the ongoing Answer film series, there will be a movie shown called Panther. And that at the ATA at 21st and Valencia Street here in San Francisco, 7 p.m. And that'll be August 11th. So the Panther movie, for people that have never seen it, I hear it's pretty good. I've never seen it myself, but, you know, we've known a lot of Panthers during my time. And they're an extension of Black August, and Black August will be having its own program hosted by the BAOG, Black August Original Organizing Committee, is that the, and Shaka and the comrades there, we having a week-long series of events, I think beginning the 19th to the 25th.
Yeah, we're going to be giving you guys a bunch more info on that, because we're going to be having a show especially dedicated to it, but there's going to be a lot of events coming up towards the end of the month. So.
But for the Panther movie, if you're interested in seeing it, please come out. That's August the 11th, Thursday, I believe, every Thursday. Same day we have our show here. Usually there's a film every fourth week. There's a film at ATA, and their number is 415-821-6545. It's all good.
All right. Thank you, Vato. So that's going to close it up for us right here, right now. We're going to play some of this. This is a pre-recorded interview, like I said, that Kilu Niasha did with Robert Bryan. I apologize to Kilu and Robert and also our listeners. They're not going to get to hear all of it, but I want to give you as much of it as we can here. And
all political prisoners, free Mumi Abu Jamal and all political prisoners, including Maribel.
Oh. All right. Thank you for listening, Prison Focus Radio. Stay tuned for Reality Sandwich. Going to be coming up at the top of the hour. But right now, check out this interview with Kilu and Robert Bryan, who is the attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I'm Kilu Niasha, and I'm here with in the studio of KPFA with San Francisco attorney Robert R. Bryan, who has specialized in death penalty litigation for over 30 years and is lead counsel in various murder cases pending at the federal and state level. He is a member of the Bar of California, New York, Alabama, the U.S. Supreme Court, various federal courts, and a fellow in the American Board of Criminal Lawyers. He was chair of the Washington-based National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty between 1987 and 90, vice chair from 91 to 93, and served 10 years on its board of directors. Robert Bryan became the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal in 2003, although he began corresponding with Mumia as early as 1985 and met him on a visit to him in Pennsylvania in 1991. Good afternoon, Robert. It's good to have you back here on in the studios of KPFA. We'll be shopping this program to various stations, hoping that we will virtually saturate the media with Mumia's case, because it is at a very critical stage at this point in time. So first I want to ask you, who is Mumia Abu-Jamal for those who may have never heard of him?
Well, first, Kilu, it's a pleasure to be here. You're one of my heroes, and I'm sure many people out there share my feeling about the great work you do, continue to do, and have done through many decades of in the area of the protecting the rights of the downtrodden and to expose human rights abuses, and it's always a pleasure to be here at KPFA. Mumia's case is at a very crucial juncture. We're at the point now where the train's moving, and it's moving very rapidly, and at the end of the tracks is the death chamber and his execution. My goal is to turn that train around, get him a new trial, and get him out. And it's a politically the case. It cannot be more political. The authorities want to kill him and shut him up because he continues to come out weekly with these incredible commentaries in which he talks about human rights abuses and many problems that plague our society and the society of the globe, the world. As far as his case, I'm sure many people are familiar with it, so I'll just touch on, if you'd like, a few points.
Want to back up just a little bit and ask you about Mumia himself. Why was he targeted? I mean, I understand he was a member of the Black Panther Party, that there are COINTELPRO files dating back to when he was in high school.
Yeah, well, Mumia has been targeted since he was actually an adolescent and a teenager because of his work as a member and one of the leaders, actually, of the Black Panther Party. And so the authorities have been after him for a long time. The problem they've had is that Mumia is not a criminal. And so they had a hard time. They once kicked the hell out of him and beat the devil out of him. And some white people were beating him, and a cop was there and put his boot to Mumia also. And as Mumia said, he kicked him right into the Black Panther Party and
yes, I believe
human rights work.
Yeah, I think they were trying to protest the presidential bid of the
George Wallace.
George Wallace.
The
overt racist of the day, and he thought with his school friends that they could go down and protest, and they really got beat half to death by some racists, and then he called the police to help him, and the police finished the job, so they literally kicked him into the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, and kicked him into being very much an advocate for the downtrodden and exposing wrongs in our society, and that's what led him to being targeted in this case and actually being on death row as we speak today. At the time, this cop was killed in Philadelphia in December of 1981. Mumia was a very well-known, very prominent radio journalist, as you are, in the Philadelphia community. And he was constantly, like the old story, the parable about the child who's saying, oh, look, the king's wearing no clothes. He was pointing out the corruption and so forth in the Philadelphia Police Department and many other wrongs that were occurring. And he was a real thorn in the side of the authorities. And they said, one of these days we're going to get you. And they thought that by charging him with murder, putting him on death row, it was a very quick trial, rush to judgment, that they would hear no more from him. Ironically, what happened is, since he's been on death row, his commentaries are now heard not just in the Philadelphia area, as they were at the time of his arrest, and some national, but now they're heard throughout much of the world weekly.
Right.
And just to finish this train of thought before I lose it, the authorities, so Mumia's become bigger rather than smaller as far as a person speaking out against human rights abuses, and the authorities now know that the only way they're going to silence him is to kill him in the name of the law, to execute him, and so the case could not be more political.
Right. He's also written 4 books.
That
Live from Death Row was the first, Death Blossoms, All Things Censored, rather. And the final book, We Want Freedom, the story
about the Black
about
Panther
the Black
Party.
Panther
yes,
Party.
Yes.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, formerly Wesley Cook, was co-founder of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party, and of course he learned journalism writing for the Black Panther newspaper and went on to become a commercial radio journalist in Philadelphia. Let's go straight to December 1981, when the officer Daniel Faulkner was murdered in the wee hours on Locust Street, I believe, in Philadelphia. It was the red light district. And Mumia, at the time, was driving a cab. Will you describe that scene and exactly what happened?
Well, it was in the wee hours of the morning.
As much as we can know.
Yes, and it was and Mumia, I will say, does not remember very much because he was shot at the scene and almost died.
Right.
It was dark, wee hours of the morning. He sees the cop stopping, had stopped somebody. The cop was hitting the person, beating the person with a heavy steel metal flashlight. And it turned out to be his brother. He ran across the street to try to help. And he wound up getting shot himself. There was somebody who fled the scene. Another person whom we think, the evidence, not just think, but the evidence certainly reflects that this person was the killer of the cop. And Mumia really doesn't know very much about what happened, except all of this occurred in a matter of seconds. Shots were fired. When other cops arrived, Faulkner, the one who died, was found there on the sidewalk, as was Mumia. Both of them had been shot. The police picked up Mumia, rammed him headfirst into a telephone post a couple of times, stomped him, and he was in agony with this wound in his chest. Threw him into a vehicle and took him to the hospital and knocked him around there some more. And they knew him. I mean, they recognized him right off. And as soon as this is the guy they had been after, they had wanted to get. And he, as I said, he had not ever committed any crimes. And so finally said, ah. And so at that point, when they arrived on the scene, it was decided at that point, without any investigation, that he must be the killer. And so from then on, the end justified the means, and that was to get him. And so all the evidence was shaped to fit him. We have discovered a wealth of facts that people who the police brought in to the trial the following summer of 1982, lied. For example, there was a prostitute in the area who testified that she saw Mumia shoot the cop. Well, what we have uncovered is evidence that, in fact, she did not arrive.
Was that Cynthia White?
Yes, and in fact, White did not show up until after the shooting. She's admitted to other people that she did not see what happened, but the cops came up to her and said, look, Cynthia, we need your help, and you we know he did it. We need you to say you saw him do it, and we'll back you on it, and we'll take pressure off of you. We'll help you, and we will not harass you. And there were various people brought in that way. For example, at the hospital, there was a wannabe cop, a security guard named Durham, Priscilla Durham. And she later testified at trial that Mumia said he shot the cop when he was in the hospital.
Well, I shot the MF or something.
And in fact, Mumia was in such a critical condition that he wasn't really able to talk, only groan and say, help me, or something like that, or get off me, when the cops were roughing him up and being so brutal to him. And we've uncovered evidence that she later admitted that the cops said, look, we're all part of a brotherhood of cops, of police officers, and we've got to stick together, and we need your help. In fact, the cop who was with Mumia at the hospital the whole time guarding him, that was his assignment, wrote in his reports that the defendant said nothing other than groaning because he was
exactly.
in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think this didn't come out until months later, that this confession.
Much longer than months. The defense tried to subpoena to get this cop into court to testify because they had the report, and he exonerated that part of that aspect of the case of Mumia. And the prosecution says, oh, gosh, we can't find him. He's on vacation. He's away. And of course, the appointed attorney who represented Mumia at trial did no pretrial investigation. The case was not prepared. And he did
Anthony
not,
Jackson, I believe.
Right, Anthony, mm-hmm. and who's since been disbarred. And he did not subpoena this cop, and he waited till virtually the time when he needed him, and said, "Well, I have a witness I need." And the question was, "Well, why did you not subpoena him months ago? You knew we were going to trial."
And so virtually, his original defense was completely incompetent.
It was legally what we say in the words of the Sixth Amendment. It was ineffective assistance of counsel. But to be more blunt, as you just were, the defense was absolutely incompetent. I mean, it was, and what's interesting is that the defense was so poorly prepared that Mamiya early on decided that he would rather represent himself. You know, he could not do any worse since his attorney wasn't doing anything. And he actually, there's a case, the Ferretta case, right on point, that held many years ago that one does have a right to represent oneself. The judge let him represent himself a little bit and then took the right away.
Okay, I just wanted to get back on. This is Mateo. You are listening to Prison Focus Radio, and you are listening to a portion of an interview done by Kilu Niasha with Robert Bryan, who is Mumia's lead defense attorney. And I want to get you back to the interview, but thanks for tuning in to Prison Focus Radio. Stay tuned for Reality Sandwich coming up next, and get you back to the interview here with Kilu and Robert Bryan.